This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Martin Walls. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Martin Walls is a Witter-Binner Fellow here at the library, and he's going to introduce himself with an opening poem.
Snail. It is a flattened shell, the color of spoiled milk, a bold swirl, slowly stirred, that charts the age of what's curled inside with the tension of a watch spring. A creature that embodies the history of metaphysics. First it exists, then it doesn't. Then it emerges once again, unrolls one, then another eye stalk, periscopes breaking the surface of its wet life. And here's the tongue body, the petal body, molding its shape to the world's shape.
That's Martin Walls, and we're at the Library of Congress honoring him because he's a Witter-Binner Fellow, chosen by the Laureate of the United States. How did Ted Kooser find you?
Well, he found me actually because of that poem, I believe. That's what he told me. That poem was originally published in a magazine called Third Coast, and Ted told me that he was published in that edition. And he wanted to use that poem in his book, the Poetry Home Repair Manual.
Which he has used, and mm-hmm. which I have taught.
Yes, and I have taught from it too.
And using your poetry is just a lot of fun.
That was originally, this was before the Witter-Binner Fellowship, that was to me a marvelous achievement and a wonderful thing for him to do. And then a few months, I believe, later, he calls me with the other news. But he had trouble finding me because there's another fellow in England called Martin Walls, and he originally went after him. I believe he's a math professor.
Oh my, you were living in England.
No, I was living in America, but this fellow was on the web, had a website, and Ted tells me that he spent a couple of months trying to track that Martin Walls down. So it's a fairly rare name. So
we've got the real Martin Walls here.
I am the real Martin Walls.
And that first poem came from what book?
That first poem is from my second book called Commonwealth,
right,
published by March Street Press.
March Street Press. They do some really fine books.
Yes,
I saw
absolutely.
Others. And tell us about the cover. My husband was fascinated with this cover.
Well, Robert Bixby, the editor, chose this. It was our second choice, and he originally had a... I write a lot about...
Well, describe the cover, since this is radio.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it is radio, of course. The cover is two diesel locomotives hooked together. And they're sort of black and white locomotives, and I thought it was particularly apt because the two subjects I like to write about are insects and small animals and locomotives and machines.
Oh, I wondered why you chose it, right.
And originally we had a small animal, I believe, a Newtor small lizard on the cover. I didn't really like that, so he came back with this, and immediately I loved it. And of course my baby son loves trains, so I thought, well, that's... And this book is dedicated to him.
It's a great cover, great book, Commonwealth by Martin Walls. He comes to us by way of Brighton
in England.
Brighton,
yes.
England. And we'll find out about that odyssey right after the next poem. This is coming out of Commonwealth too, right?
Yes, and this is called A Map of Great Britain Excluding Scotland.
Love that.
I put the newspaper down, my hands resting before me. They become Newquay, the small fishing town in Cornwall. The fingers of one hand, granite cliffs dipped in the Irish Sea. Those on the other, sand that arcs around the bay. I am full of coal. I am riddled with smugglers' caves. Things have been hidden in me for centuries. The nation sends down brave men to find them. I am a grass-covered bridge in Northumberland, across which soldiers and priests marched to Scotland, on which I've seen sheep dead of cold and hunger, crows growing black on the eclipse of their eyes. I'm a Roman road, a Saxon church, a broken city wall, a heavy forest saved from the axe by the king, where the barn owl roars at dusk. The gate is shut, the cattle home. I lay my head. In my blood, the shunt and shuttle of traffic and people, my friends are trying to escape. My backbone is the London to Brighton line that for 30 years carried my father to the government. My brother lives in Gypsy Hill. I hear him kick off his shoes and pick up the phone in my heart. When I was young, there was a girl who was a beach for me. Southold Beach in Suffolk, a place of fine sand, climbing dog rose. She was the beach. Crabs danced on her breasts. The sun rose between her legs and died in her eyes. Happiness was just another title in the bookstore. Light bleached, besotted with dust, too dear. I take great memory strides. One step, I'm in the wide, winding streets in the hills above Swansea. Another, I'm in Oxford. Another, and it's Sunday morning, Camden Town. One more, and I'm in Diss, the market town in Norfolk, where two great swans become my shoulder blades, and my arms, the rivers, Waveney and Yare.
I adored submerging myself and immersing myself in the English feel of this book, and especially the tales from being a youngster and growing up in the different places and what you ate at school. And I got so involved with it. It was like a high level of gossip from Europe, you know?
Yes.
And yet there is an interior life that comes out of that, of course. And from your geography becomes, I get a very strong identity of you. And then, which our listeners will find soon, you go into detail, detail, detail. So we go from the stacks of England down into the centipede and the snail and the ant, and we'll be hearing some of those poems.
Yes.
But you come from, make it very large,
yeah,
and then you get microscopic in this book. Was that intentional?
That is it broadly intentional. I'm maybe unusual in that you sort of described I have a very, some of my poems have a very wide focus. Those poems can be quite political. Not political in a polemic kind of way, but political as a way to describe the world I grew up in, which even in England was a different world.
And it's more commentary than polemic, I would
say. It's more, and history.
It is historical,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What years were you growing
up? Well,
and
it's not so long ago, which is the odd thing. I grew up in the 1970s. I was born in 1970, and I left England in the year, well, I was about 21. So,
tell us about your odyssey then to the States. Why you came here?
Well, originally I came to the States first with my family on vacation, a long time ago, about 1981. And in fact, I visited Washington D.C. for the first time then, and the country, frankly, blew my mind. I was only 11 years old, and of course, it was, you know, America was something of a mecca to a young person growing up in England then. Then years later, I got onto the American and English Literature and American Studies program at the University of East Anglia in England, which was a...
That was your college?
Yes, that was my college. And that was a groundbreaking program, and although it's common nowadays, then the idea of having a year abroad for study was very new. And I did that year abroad, and I went to Trinity College in Connecticut.
I know it, I do.
And which is where I first took creative writing lessons. And my interest in writing poetry got stronger and stronger and stronger. And to be quite frank, after I left college, there wasn't really much work. There was high unemployment. And I simply used poetry as a way to get back to the United States, and I was lucky enough to get onto the program at Purdue University.
We are happy to have you. Welcome aboard. So Martin Walls, he's reading from his new book, Commonwealth, and we're at the Library of Congress. What will you read us next?
Well, I'll read one of those historical poems, and actually this poem is called, I said I don't write political poems, but I've written a series called The Socialist Poems.
Oh, yeah.
And The Socialist Poems, this is an attempt to describe, really, my biography as part of the social and political scene growing up, which was came to an end during Margaret Thatcher's reign. She really changed our country so terrifically that you know, one way of life, as far as I can see, came to an end and a new one started. But the way of life before was, you know, we lived in a quite a socialist country, not just with the welfare state, but nationalized industries, strong unions, and it was sort of, it really was a different world. It wasn't all that long ago, but it feels, the important thing to me is it feels a long time
ago. But you had
ago.
Milk before you had, then you had orange squash, though. Lots yes. of things changed in the schools.
Well, that's yeah, that's another one of my socialist poems I describe, kindergarten, where we would thanks to the socialist government, we would all get a lovely glass of milk at lunchtime or break time. And it was one Mrs. Thatcher who was then the education minister who took that away.
Oh, so let's hear it. Let's.
Oh,
hear
would
it.
You like that? That's
no,
not,
any socialist poem.
Oh,
you
this
give
is so. This is the first one. This is socialist poem number one.
Right.
And the subtitle of this is England: The Winter of Discontent, 1978 mm-hmm. to 79. That was the year that the strong unions all decided to strike during you know, tough economic period, and that's really what brought down the last English socialist government. This is meant to be in a voice of a young person I was then. I am seven, and see things simply, as a fish does. I can see the flat colours of the 1970s, greens, browns, cold greys like fading Kodachrome. I see the unburied of the gravediggers' strike, the bat-black mortuaries crawling with terror, and monsterish heaps of uncollected trash bags, evil-smelling, pulling snow into their black folds as if they're pantomime villains making off with the hero. All day scavenging seagulls squawk in a festering sky. Evenings, the sounds of crisis mix with the smell of frying fat, pungent Polish coal. On TV, I watch Mr. Callahan sing, "I'm the man who waters the workers' beer" at the Labour Party conference. Later, he's beetling from number 10 in his shiny black Bentley. Socialists. Their winters as cold and harsh as nylon sheets. At 6:30, electricity's cut off, the union on a 3-day week. So we sit in the kitchen while Mum smokes her thin cigarettes and Grandma's reminded of the war. Hazy blue light from the gas stove throws crazy shadows against the wall. Doom dark drifts against the house. An awful reverse snow. Above the rattle of boiling spuds, my transistor radio speaks a strange tongue. Tripartite bargaining. Arbitration, it trills. 7 o'clock. Soon Dad'll be home, hair slick from snow drizzle. No shower till the heater growls awake. 9:30. I fold icy sheets around me, keeping the curtains open. The moon glows like a pilot light. All winter, I've watched filaments of ice lay down shapes in the corner of the window. A spaceship, a fabulous continent, a rose. Tonight, a hand sets out. It grows into one of Grandpa's big, bony hands. Only it grows bigger than that, more scary, pain after pain in its clutch.
Terrific. You know, how poetry is better than journalism. We learn so much more of the news in it. And I say you're going to give adjectives a good name. You are the adjective king.
Well,
and hyphenated words, too. I mean, you're bringing them back into style.
Yes, it's part of my craft. This is something I not only learned from my teachers at Purdue, Marianne Baruch and Tom Andrews, and Neil Myers, who really saw that I...
They helped?
They saw that I had, well, maybe not even a talent, but I just loved making metaphors. And so they pushed me. And they told me to read some of the great poets that are still writing today who are metaphor makers. I think Charles Wright is the most important influence for me there.
But you get more bang from a line than anyone I know right now. Does anyone bring up Dylan Thomas to you?
Funnily enough, no.
Why not? When I read your The Density, mm-hmm. which was so intricate and so detailed and so well developed, it brought back Dylan Thomas
I think I'm so influenced by Dylan Thomas. I barely even read him anymore. I've absorbed. I would if I was to flatter myself, I'd love to sort of place myself within the line of late romantics that really Dylan Thomas took up.
Let me do it for you then, because I saw that in the line, mm-hmm. and I thought, I bet people say that to him, and so mm-hmm. I'm very surprised that they don't.
No.
And also, are you Welsh? I mean, is there Welsh in you?
It's funny you should say that. My mother has recently found that we have Welsh, and her family has Welsh ancestry, so she's very... She'd be very happy to hear.
It's seeping through, absolutely.
But there are other English and also Irish poets who, I say so influenced because, of course, I was lucky enough to read them at college and study them at college without really studying their craft so much. But, of course, Seamus Heaney, especially his first book. And funnily enough for me, especially with my, let's say, my politics and my social views, Philip Larkin is an enormous influence, partly because he is, I would say, even more than those, even more than Dylan Thomas and Seamus Heaney. He's a master craftsman.
Yes, but I think you sound more like Thomas. Yeah.
with my accent?
No, I think it's with your hyphenated words.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And the way you juxtapose adjectives.
Must be an Anglo-Saxon thing. But I also read a lot of European poets. Thomas Tranströmer, the Swedish poet, is a big influence on me. French poets, in the original, but you know, obviously in translation as well, like Francis Ponge. The detail you've mentioned, but also the way the metaphors are built,
mm-hmm.
And the use of the sort of hyphenated adjectives is all a way of creating metaphors in ways that are more interesting than just saying like this, like
it's
that.
It's layers and layers and layers.
Yes.
Very rich, intricate.
Well,
and
as soon as you decide you're going to describe objects and make metaphors in ways other than simply using a simile, which is what a lot of young poets do, then your language naturally becomes richer because you have to use more of the language. Adjectives, verbs become metaphors.
And do you know what I call it? Energy. Because when I read your book, and I had my little stick-em note by me in bed, and I'm scribbling what I thought, I write mm-hmm. energy, 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 energy mm-hmm. for every poem, because that's what's under the line. If you didn't have that, mm-hmm. you couldn't line all those babies up. Mm-hmm. So let's hear some more. This is Martin Walls, and I am Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress.
Well, this is a poem. As I said, I like to write about wider subjects, history, politics, but also concentrate sometimes on objects and animals. And this is from my first book, Small Human Detail in Care of National Trust, and this is a poem called Cicadas at the End of Summer. Cicadas at the end of summer whine as though a pine tree is bowing a broken violin, as though a bandsaw cleaves a thousand thin sheets of titanium. They chime like freight wheels on a Norfolk Southern slowing into town. But all you ever see is the silence. Husks glued to the underside of maple leaves. With their 1950s Bakelite lines, they'd do just as well hanging from the ceiling of a space museum. What cicadas leave behind is a kind of crystallized memory, the stubborn detail of the shape around a life turned the color of forgotten things, a cold broth of tea and milk in the bottom of a mug, or skin on an old tin of varnish you have to lift with lineman's pliers, a flypaper that hung 30 years in Bird Cooper's pantry in Brighton.
Martin Walls, that was Small human detail in care of National Trust. And now we need to talk a little bit about the tiny creatures that have invaded your psyche, and you've made deities of little bugs. I think that Ted Kooser has met his match, because you will spend an hour looking at a centipede. Or what is it that allows you to make that tiny creature such a metaphor?
Oh, well, I think it's those sorts of poems started out as ways for me to become more serious as a poet, and to become more serious as a poet, you need to, I think, have a lot more attention to the details of the world.
And you did that purposely.
I did it purposely. In fact, a poem like Cicadas at the End of Summer, I could say would be a sort of a student piece that I decided, coming from England, I'd never seen a cicada before. So they're naturally incredible, and their little shells that they leave behind when they molt, which litter in Lafayette in Indiana, where I went to graduate school, they litter the sidewalks in late summer. And so I just decided to sit down with it one day.
Give us another.
Poem. Well, I'll read another little bug poem. This one is called Pill Bugs from my book Commonwealth.
Oh, yeah.
And again, this is an act of pure concentration. And really, this is the deep influence on these poems as well is the French poet Francis Ponge, who wrote I believe is one of the greatest books of poetry in the 20th century, and with a beautiful title I wish I could steal, called On the Side of Things.
I am going to go check it out.
It is, and he really writes about small things, bugs, and it was just when I first read those poems, I suddenly realized, wow, you could, you know, it was the
what
world in a grain
do.
Of sand idea of William Blake, of course, and so I decided to copy that impulse, but with an English sensibility and American bugs. Pill bugs, in England we call these wood lice. These are the bugs, as you'll hear in the poem, the ones that crawl along and you touch them and they roll up, and they sort of live in soil and wood. A convex length of desiccated spruce bark beside the herbs to catch pests. A detached cuff of wood loosened by disassembling heat. I stand in the half-naked shade and peek beneath the trap to see what's mustard. Snails glued in a row like leather buttons, earwigs on a slick journey out of the deep past. Pill bugs, the color of tempered steel, simple, beautiful as a first invention. The cam wheel, block and tackle, Archimedes screw. They gladden my heart. Their few well-turned parts, the clicks, the neat fit with eternity, like great poetry. Insects don't weep, even stars grow apart. To speak clearly, the dictionary says, is articulate, which is also to be built with several joints. These pill bugs walk easy on their comma feet, as if on grease. Back plates slide straight to curve, smartly as baggage carousels. And they've one more trick. I touch one and quick, it curls up tight as a bearing, a fortress, a cannonball. So cinched, Dad used them to play marbles before the war, when pennies pinched. When the word articulate is furled, we're left with art. I swill them round the spruce bark, then watch them open, iron petals. Watch as they start moving round the pieces of a dream.
What is that wonderful line? When the world articulate is furled,
we're left with art.
We're left with art. Now, did that come first, and then it came out of that poem? You didn't have that.
No, that came
written
out
on the back of your bedpost.
No, that was poem's sort
it
of created itself. Really.
Now here's what they say about him: Philip Memmer says this, spiders and moths, fireflies and centipedes, and each of us as well, are the residents of Martin Wall's Commonwealth, a gorgeous new anthill of a book that evokes page by page the holy yes of boys who stare in wonder. Wall's invertebrates are rendered with startling detail, and it's upon that simple lives, as one spider reminds us, that he's built his philosophy. And he says this very, very well, because you are praising nature at the same time changing it, so I'll never look at one of those things again without thinking it's glorious.
That's really
what you've done.
One of the things a poet ought to do, I think. It's a simple thing.
All things that grow or crawl, Martin Walls has blessed. We would like to hear some more.
Harvestman Spider. The harvestman spider, arbiter of suspension, thinks, I've dug this trench to test her. Now she's bouncing through the cilantro bed. To her, a forest of lace and spice. Smooth motion. Her body, a drop of axle grease covered in lint, which at first seems held aloft by sleight of hand, perhaps magnetic levitation. The truth's just as incredible. Those legs, as fine as the needles on a seismograph, they track the slightest vibration, even this poem.
Martin Walls, I'm Grace Cavalieri at the Library of Congress, and we will tell you that he is the Witterbinner Fellow for this year, chosen by the United States Poet Laureate, and we're at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.